It's what I would call a collaborative growth environment. We learn together by collaborating on how we learn together. And there are so many things that you can't measure in a numerical context. You have to be there to see it. But in some cases, you don't know the value or the impact that even something like that has until after it's done, or even in some cases, many, many years later. My passion is primarily along the lines of the fact that you can bridge the achievement and equitable gap. And then now, of course, what do you do with it in the context of bridging that gap?
Welcome to the Rethinking Learning Podcast. I'm Barbara Bray. This is where I have conversations with educators, leaders, and change agents about their passion to transform teaching and learning. Welcome, everyone, to the Rethinking Learning Podcast series. Today, this is pretty special. I have Ken Shelton here, and I am just really excited to talk to Ken because I've known him for a long time. But let me tell you a little bit about him first. Ken Shelton has been an educator for over 14 years. He holds an MA in Educational Technology as well as New Media Design and Production. Ken regularly gives keynotes, and I have to say, they're amazing. I had to put that in on the side. Presentations and leads workshops, many which are hands-on, covering a wide variety of educational technology, creative expression, visual storytelling, and instructional design topics. He's currently the global keynote specialist and educational technology strategist for the EdTech team. And like I said, I've known Ken for many years, and I try to attend his sessions and be in, like a fly on the wall over there, you know, because he's always coming up with new, exciting ideas.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, Ken.
Thank you.
You know, I saw you at ISTE, and I've seen you many, many times, and we have our selfies. We're going to have to put some of those up on the blog that goes with this. But Ken, do you mind? I just want to just have people get to know you just kind of personally, a little bit about you and your family and your background.
Okay. Well, I live in Los Angeles. I am a left coast kind of guy. So I grew up here in Los Angeles. You know, I also went to college here in Los Angeles at UCLA, go Bruins. But I have, you know, and of course, growing up in LA has exposed me to a number of different things. I would say it's interesting that, you know, I played sports. I played sports in college, but I also learned how to surf in my teens. In addition to all of that, you know, living here in Los Angeles, I spent a number of years in the acting and modeling industry, especially modeling. That, in addition to my athletic background, has afforded me a lot of opportunities that I think have kind of shaped how I am now. I started working in education early on as a substitute teacher back when I was in between jobs, you know, whether it was for a commercial or a modeling job. And I recognized that education was important, an important component of my life. I actually come from a family of educators. My father was the chief business officer and assistant superintendent for the Los Angeles County Office of Ed. He also was the Santa Clara County Office of Ed, and then Solana County as well. So between that and my grandfather, one of my grandfathers, it was in the military, post-military, he was an educator. And my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, was an educator. So, you know, being an African-American family, we have a long history of educators because the importance of education was instilled upon really my family on both sides many, many generations ago. And this goes all the way back to when my paternal grandmother was one of nine siblings growing up on a farm in Alabama, and her father put every single one of his children through college. You know, so ultimately education has been, like I said, a significant component of the family, and it's been important for me. And in the early days, you know, early, when I was in high school, one of the things I wanted to do when I grew up was not only play professional football, but after that, I wanted to be able to teach and coach football in high school. That, I think, kind of shaped my perspective on education as far as when I was a substitute teacher, I realized that, okay, if you're going to do anything with this, then you need to get the credential. And then ultimately the credential led to the master's degree, and the doctorate has been was put on hold, but I've been strongly encouraged by a number of folks recently that I need to go ahead and get into a program and get that done. So, so that's basically family background. I currently have three children, all girls. So I'm a father of girls. And, you know, I want all of my girls to essentially be afforded many of the opportunities that I was as a result of being diligent and committed to performing well in an educational setting.
So I didn't know about your father. I didn't know about that, about the being a superintendent. Yeah. And that's pretty interesting, especially your history with your, you know, your grandparents too in education.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the funny thing about my dad as well is that a lot of times either he or I will be out and about somewhere and someone will say, "Oh, Ken Shelton, that name sounds familiar." And usually when they say it to me, I'm like, "Well, yeah, you probably know my dad." And then now with my dad, it's funny because he'll say, "Oh yeah, you probably know my son." So it's really quite humorous that when my dad and I share stories of meeting people within education that know one or the two of us, especially because of our name.
Oh, I love that. Well, can you tell me the ages and names of your kids?
Yeah, so my oldest is Alice, she's 17, then Kennedy is 10, and Kiana is 8.
Oh, I love those names. How beautiful.
Well,
I don't know, it's up to you if you want to put pictures up of your family, because it's fun to do too, just to share. But
I can send you something.
Yeah, no problem. Oh, I love it. Well, I know you're in educational technology, because that's how I met you. I met you through the conferences. But the one thing I know is your passion. Why are you so passionate about educational technology and, you know, all the other things that you do around that?
I think a big part of that stems from my own personal experience, really in college, but I would say the big epiphany was after college, that when technology is utilized appropriately and the appropriate degree of access is given, that can be a significant pillar in the bridging of any achievement gap or the equitable divide. You know, I've advised a number of schools when asked, especially if I know the administrators there, that, you know, if you take the socioeconomic status or the median socioeconomic status of a student at a Title I school versus a school that has, you know, a $10 million endowment, if both students have appropriate access to technology, let's say a Chromebook or an iPad or something like that, then theoretically you're bridging that equitable divide and the achievement gap because they have access to the exact same thing. You know, the internet is free and open. You can't access things on the internet based on your socioeconomic status. It's there for everybody. So for me, I think a big part of that was looking at how does technology provide the term I use actually in one of my keynotes is how does it provide transformative learning experiences for teachers and students? And then how can we capitalize off of those experiences to allow students and teachers to do things that if it weren't for the technology, they wouldn't be able to do? And in all honesty, when I used to teach history, there were a number of glaring omissions in the social studies textbooks that now if you have access to the internet, you can fill those gaps or you can vet the breadth and quality of the information that's being put in a textbook. And this is one of the reasons why I really would love to see more and more school districts take the money, the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars they spent on textbooks, and use that to acquire technology and provide the teachers and the students with the right degree of support in using that technology. Because I personally think that textbooks, as far as a primary mechanism for information and instructional delivery, are obsolete.
Oh, well, we have to talk about this a little because this is the goal that I've been wanting, because I was in social studies and worked with social studies teachers, and the textbooks, I didn't even agree with what they said about history and the kids.
Right.
So one thing that's really nice now is that kids can have a voice. They can actually go back and talk to, you know, talk about historical events and even tie it to the present. And some of these kids never get a voice, but just when I did it, and I know when you did it, wasn't it amazing what they came up with?
It's amazing what they come up with. And the other side to it, even not, if you just take any content area, is that you now have the potential for access to primary sources. And yeah, I mean, I've heard dozens of stories of friends that teach English where they'll post something on Twitter of a book they're reading and they'll tag the author. And next thing you know, the author's like, oh, I'd love to chat with the class. I mean, like, you don't get that from a textbook. You can't. And think about the power of a teacher and a student that we're reading X author's book, and it's what I would call a collaborative growth environment. We learn together by collaborating on how we learn together. And there are so many things that you can't measure in a numerical context. You have to be there to see it. But in some cases, you don't know the value or the impact that even something like that has until after it's done, or even in some cases, many, many years later. And so that's why I think that ultimately, yeah, it's my passion is primarily along the lines of the fact that you can bridge the achievement and equitable gap. And then now, of course, what do you do with it in the context of bridging that gap?
I've seen even kindergartners using Seesaw or other programs where they're teaching each other strategies.
Exactly. And think about the layers that they're doing in doing that, that it's not, you know, we look at it, we're seeing, okay, well, here's a kindergartner teaching another kindergartner. But let's go deeper into that. One, they're learning effective communication. Two, it's what I would call a collaborative growth environment. We learn together by collaborating on how we learn together. And there are so many things that you can't measure in a numerical context. You have to be there to see it. But in some cases, you don't know the value or the impact that even something like that has until after it's done, or even in some cases, many, many years later. And so that's why I think that ultimately, yeah, it's my passion is primarily along the lines of the fact that you can bridge the achievement and equitable gap. And then now, of course, what do you do with it in the context of bridging that gap?
So, well, just like the conversation we're having, our kids need those. The thing that and I'm going to get a little controversial, but it's about the way that technology is used by some companies is to use an algorithm that's similar to Amazon. If you like this, you must like this. Where kids, if we give them the opportunity to talk to each other, when they talk, like I'm talking to you, it's giving, my head is thinking, oh gosh, I just thought of this. I want to be able to share. So you're bouncing ideas off of each other and building that collaborative environment you talked about.
Right, right. You know, I'll even take you one step further. I don't even think that that's controversial, because it is known that there are a number of companies that they curate user data. I honestly don't really have a problem with them curating user data as long as it is used in a capacity to improve an existing product. Not for, we have this demographic for sales. I mean, you know, Google, you know, your regular Google account, your searches, they have the data of who performs what searches, which is why they can focus target ads. I know people have an issue with that, but I've reminded some people I've spoken to before that that's basically the way the Nielsen rating system worked back when I was a teenager and then some. They have the demographics of who watched a particular program on primetime television, and then they could then sell ad space during that program to specific businesses who have that as their target audience. My main thing with data and things like that is twofold. It's one, you know, as far as in it, from an educator space, if you're using technology because the data shows that it is a good thing to do, then one, that's very limited in scope. And the other thing that I always caution educators to do is to not digitize their lessons. You need to be using technology in an appropriate and effective manner. The other side to it is businesses, what I would say the savvy businesses, do have conversations with students and teachers to look at how can we design a platform or an experience that enhances something you're already doing, or again, using that word, can be transformative in what you're doing. So therefore, they are taking that information or that data and they're putting it to good use.
You can visualize data. And that brings me to all the things you do with visualization and storytelling. And, I'm into the digital storytelling also. And I'm also working about visualizing data. That's another piece that I'm working on right now. And so I'd love you kind of just to, since that's every time I go in and I, when that session, I learn something new. So why are visuals so and stories so important? I mean, they do matter, because for me, this is one reason why I'm doing the podcast series, is I find that I learn something new about everyone I'm talking to, and I've learned several things new about you already. So why do they matter?
Well, the science is already out that shows that we are wired for storytelling. And I love sharing it with other educators that either are speakers or have an interest in becoming speaker, that conversations that we have with our friends and our family are essentially nothing more than a series of storytelling. They're not like you and I aren't having a conversation of which we have a bulleted list that we need to hit on every single point as we go. So there's the storytelling component that has existed for thousands of years that we have. The visual side of it for me is that visuals have a way of being universally communicable. So I'll give you an example. In one of the sessions that I do on visual storytelling and visual literacy is I take the audience through a series of icons, and it's just simply icons. And I'm like, well, what is being communicated to us with these icons? And of course, you know, if you have a room of 100, more than 95 out of the 100 are going to identify this particular icon as communicating the exact same thing. And I said, and so think about it in the context of now looking globally. There are icons that are used globally that do communicate that same message. And for me, the visual aspect is twofold. One, it's, again, universally communicable and universally accessible. And then two, there are so many layers to compelling images that we look at that's precisely why you have to do a detailed and depth and in-depth analysis of the image to look at who was the author of it, i.e. the photographer or the painter or something. Who's the author of it? What was the time with which it was produced? What was the context with which it was produced? Why is that particular image or that painting or that visual representation the one that they selected to distribute versus the many, many, many others that they probably had? And then three, you know, a lot of times it just builds a degree of what I call more observe. It makes us more observant of things. And especially now where you have kids that are so fast to try to post on Snapchat, post on Instagram, they got to capture that moment right now. And in many cases, what I share with educators is a lot of times kids are so focused on the here and now that's right in front of them that they see, you know, the speck of what could be a bigger picture and not looking at, well, what's going on around me. So I think that the visuals, again, it's a universally communicable and accessible way of storytelling. There are so many layers. I mean, you know the old saying, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Okay, well, that means that I can take one medium and share it and tell essentially 1,000-word story. People are more likely to gravitate towards that image than they are to, if I were to put on text, 1,000-word story. We just do that.
When I put an image with my Twitter, when I tweet out with an image, it goes a lot more viral than if I don't. It grabs people because they want to know a little bit more about it.
Exactly.
So that's really fun because every time you share pictures, they're always a little different, and I love it. And you did the thing about icons, which is so true because we recognize labels and icons pretty easily because of advertising and things like that. But how do we use it to encourage others to tell their stories and what types of visuals they put in? I love that. One of the posts or something you talked about was creating learning environments that are for sustainability, equity, and access. And teachers, and this is tough. This is tough for teachers. So what are some ideas and some of the things that you were talking about?
So essentially what I looked at, and it's multi-tiered, but essentially what I looked at is I juxtapose the difference between equity and equality, which they are very different. I looked at the system as a whole, and especially larger school districts, where there is this irresponsible emphasis on student stratification. You know, for example, you have a school that has honors and AP classes, then they have the regular classes, then they have the remedial classes. And in the extensive amount of research that I've done, I have seen a pattern. You know, speaking of data, we look at data, we look for patterns and trends. I've seen a pattern and a trend where there is a disproportionate percentage of students either along a race or socioeconomic status that are generally steer towards the mid-level or remedial classes. When you think about equitability and access, that there's two components to that. There's the socioeconomic component, and then there's the geographical component. So I've had the opportunity to speak at a number of events in areas that, let's just say, are not large cities, and equitable access is a challenge in many of our rural areas as well. So my main thing of that is it kind of goes back to a class that I had in college where it was a sociology class, and the professor was bringing up, the big question was, at the time, you know, should college athletes be paid? And most of my classmates were like, no, you get a scholarship, your school is paid for. No. Now, me, of course, being the only athlete at the time that was in that particular class, I can say, well, wait, hold on. There are a lot more things to being an athlete in college than just simply what you look at on Saturday afternoon. There's the requirements for practice. I still have to take classes, you do. There's requirements for working out. There are other things that you are required to do that equate to a full-time job that the university theoretically is benefiting from because they make a lot of money off of television, bowl revenue, ticket sales, merchandise sales. Not a single dime of that goes to that athlete, even if they have the athlete's name on the jersey. And so my whole thing was that you need to think about, if they're not being paid, well, what is their investment in their time that they are doing it? Because the scholarship, and I remember seeing, again, going back today, I remember seeing a statistic, and I don't remember the exact number, but it said a college athlete at a major university, the total cost of their scholarship was, I'm just throwing out a number, was like, let's say $200,000. But if you look at how much money the school brings in from bowl games, television revenue, conference shared revenue, ticket sale, that one athlete is bringing in about $1 million. So there was a major disparity between those two. And so the reason why I'm sharing that is going back to the equity and accessibility, how many learning spaces exist right now of which the conversations and the learning opportunities are severely limited or skewed because of a lack of accessibility? You know, you think about what's going on in society right now where, you know, the awareness of a lot of social injustice is being brought back to the forefront. Well, for some of us, it's always been there. It hasn't gone away. But it's raised awareness. And so when you think about conversations that teachers should be having with their kids and that adults should be having with other adults, I would love to see opportunities for schools and teachers to be able to provide more students with the accessibility to be a part of those learning experiences and those conversations, to provide more depth so that we can build a degree of understanding, awareness, and empathy in everybody. And then in turn, the other thing that I really emphasized in that particular session was every time that you tell a child that they are no good through either omission or commission. So in other words, if I tell you you're no good because I tell you you shouldn't take honors and AP classes, which by the way, when I was in high school, I had a counselor that specifically told me those classes aren't for you. And my dad insisted on me taking them. And I was just like, I don't care what she says, I'm taking them anyway. And through in my high school, I was the only African American who took honors and AP classes for my entire high school career. Think about what it says to a child that you're not good enough to take these classes, we're going to put you in those, and then they're in a class where it already has a negative connotation to it. How much human capital have we lost by doing that over and over and over, year after year after year? There was a school district in New York that they looked at that dynamic and recognized that they had the moral imperative to do something different. And so it took some time for them to do it, but they phased out all of the lower tiered classes and only had honors and AP classes. And then in turn, yes, there are some students that are going to be better apt to perform at a higher level than others. The students that needed the additional support were provided the additional support. It wasn't intervention. They didn't use that word. It wasn't, oh, you need remedial. I mean, that's the thing. Words matter. It was, if you are having difficulty with this class, we are providing you with several avenues for additional support. And that's what they did. And yes, the biggest naysayers were the community because the parents, they don't want their kids and I don't want my kid to take classes with those kids. And I remember reading a quote from one of the assistant principals that said, you know what? Those kids are in our school. Our school is a community. So we need to support all of our kids.
Wow. I want to know about this school, by the way, because I think that sounds one that we need to share more. And yes. A lot of people have these types of experiences and their voices are not heard. They don't have a voice in the school or And more schools are trying to figure out how do we make it more democratic so kids have a voice in actual decisions at the school. And I love that you did this. It must have been tough. It must have been tough for you, right?
Well, it's an area of passion that I have that you know, to ISTE's credit, they actually accepted the session.
Okay.
I didn't expect them to accept it, but I did go in submitting a proposal under the guise that, you know, if you don't submit it, you know for sure it won't get in. So at least give it a chance. I think that, you know, you're seeing now where, you know, I have reached out to a number of ISTE affiliates because I'm looking at the demographic of the speakers that they continually have, and they have theoretically by commission denied someone like me a voice because they haven't had a non-white educator as a keynote speaker. And, you know, the conversations I've had with educators across the race spectrum, you know, especially if they work with students like that look like me, you know, the African-American male student, you know, one of the first questions I always ask is, you know, what is your discipline policy? And is it skewed against students like me? Because if it is, then I would also look at the fact that there might be a higher degree of a lack of cultural awareness that what you identify as a behavior problem may not necessarily be a problem. It's a lack of awareness. And I also think, just like you just said, that in the ideal and equitable environment, you have to have technology because you have to be able to give each and every student a platform for their voice. And it's critical.
Well, Ken, we could go on for probably another hour or so, but I have to kind of keep the podcast but we're going to be talking more about this and maybe write a little bit about it in the blog that goes with this. Okay. So we can at least get this information out about equity and access, but also why it means so much for every child to have a voice. Like what you're saying, it's so important. And also us. If you have a message that is really valuable, we need to make sure that you have that opportunity to share it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you even said it yourself. I mean, here's a big question. How many stories are going on in classrooms and schools today that we don't know?
Yeah. And that's one of the things both of us have been trying to do is tell your story. Get it out there because the story really matters. So I'm afraid I have to try to pull this to close. So I want to just, what do you believe is going to be, well, the next important thing to share? And what is, you know, that big thing?
Well, beyond what I've just shared in regards to, you know, the equity and accessibility is, I think you've already touched on it, is the storytelling. You know, that's the next big thing. Well, it is a big thing now, but I would like to see it be more amplified is each mechanism or each component within education being able to effectively tell their stories. Because if you don't tell your own story, somebody else will.
Was that your quote?
No, that is I actually learned that from two people. I learned that derivatives of that quote from Jenny McGarrah.
Oh yeah. She's
fantastic. And then my buddy exactly, she is. I love her dearly. And then my buddy Jason Marquis, who is a principal at a high school in the Chicago area. And the short version of what could be a long story along the lines with that was the fact that one of the emphasis that Jason had with his school was controlling the message through the use of social media and encouraging students to use social media. And then, of course, with Jenny in one of her recent keynotes, she kind of touches on that as well, is that, you know, if you don't tell your story, somebody else will. And I haven't used those specific words, but I have said you need to make sure that your representation is appropriately distributed or represented, because it goes back to when I was in elementary school where you used to play that game called telephone, where everyone would sit in a circle and the teacher would tell one student something and then they'd whisper in the ear of the next students. And by the time it came around, it's a completely different story.
That's right.
So that's why we have to be able to represent our stories in the capacity that we would be proud of, comfortable with, and that tells the real story, not somebody else's.
Well, we did have a little bit of your story today, and it was just amazing. I love the conversation today with you, Ken.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. This has been great.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining Rethinking Learning Conversations on Learning with Ken Shelton today. This is going to be one that I'm really excited to share. Thank you so much. Bye, Ken.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rethinking Learning podcast and my conversation with Ken Shelton. So make sure you visit barbarabray.net to learn more about Ken, his projects, and all the wonderful work he does on storytelling and equity. Please subscribe so you don't miss the conversations.